might want to be able to respond to that online. Nielsen type polls, what programs are being watched and how long? Could I have the next slide, please? This is a schematic block diagram of a typical home terminal. Modern cable TV systems will be dual cable, an A and a B cable. Earlier there was a rather strange device called an AB switch. It merely allows you to select either the A cable or the B cable. Each cable carries on the order of 20 to 30 channels of cable TV. On cable A, the TV signals go into a set-top converter and into the TV set. The function of the set-top converter is to translate the normal TV frequencies and the unusual cable frequencies, which are located between channels 6 and 7 and above channel 13 in frequency, translate them to an unused TV slot in the region that this set would be located. For example, in Washington, D.C., there is no channel 8. All signals would be converted and appear on this set on its channel 8. At some later date, if they ever do build TV sets for cable, this function and that will, and the tuner in here would be incorporated. The problem here is that there are more than the normal 12 channels. And secondly, because of the different propagation time for a signal coming in over the air, leaking into the back of the TV set because of the way the current TV set is built, versus the path through the cable, one gets what's called direct pickup, so that channel 4, say in Washington, would appear as a ghost image on channel 4 if we were to use channel 4 on the cable. On cable B, coming through the receiver demodulator, after serial to parallel conversion, an address decoder, if it decides that the information being sent is for this subscriber, allows the function decoder to pass through the gating circuits functions to external devices such as fire alarms, burglar alarms, home refresh devices. Fire alarms and burglar alarms are systems that are currently being tested by a number of the smaller CATV manufacturers. Signals, of course, could pass back. Similarly, the subscriber in the home through his push buttons can send information which is converted and sent back over the line. Can I have the next slide, please? Okay, I'd like to come back to this. Could we show the film now, please? Could you show it at slow speed? Well, this is time interactive, computer controlled informational television. From our facilities in McLean, Virginia, where we're using a 360/50 computer in our demonstration, which will later be converted to a small mini computer system, we're microwaving signals to the new community of Reston, Virginia, which is about 7 to 10 miles away. The signals are received by the head end, shown here, the towers, of the Reston Transmission Company, which is cooperating with MITRE in this particular demonstration. This picture depicts a young man in his home using the push-button telephone to respond back to the computer facility at MITRE. Shown here, but hard to see, you can see it better later, is the home calculator. Since this system is time interactive, computer controlled informational television, another way you can think of this in terms of actual video information being sent, it's really time division multiplex TV. What's shown here are pictures being updated once every second. If they were updated once every 3 seconds, and if a camera were trained on a blackboard, as we've demonstrated in Reston, in the case of updating once every 3 seconds, one could portray 180 different lectures over the same video channel. Now, in the case of a satellite link, where you're obviously trying to conserve bandwidth, you can basically portray something which is stop action, but continuous audio, such as a lecture, and lose nothing in the way of information, at least not very much useful. We've tried this out, and we have been talking with a number of other institutions to try to really try this out on a larger scale. This is what you'd see if you didn't have the frame grabber and the decoder in your home. You just see frames shooting past you. This is if you were in Reston and you tuned to channel 13. This would be shooting past you constantly. In the case of the dynamic addressing, which I mentioned earlier, as the young lady's doing here, she tunes in and is requesting frame 200. Frame 200 provides information leading to other bits of information, etc. Some of the types of information that you can get are being shown right now on the screen. The majority of these are of the types that are really retrieved through the use of the push-button telephone in the home. Now, while you're sort of glancing at a variety of the services that we're demonstrating every Tuesday morning in Reston, Virginia, I'd like to describe to you what some of the goals were and why we were doing this demonstration. First of all, like all demonstrations, we were trying to demonstrate something. We were trying to demonstrate the operation of a low-cost computer interactive TV system in the home. We were interested in catalyzing the development of this type of hardware by cable system operators and equipment manufacturers. We were also interested in getting the city, state, and federal planners to begin thinking about the impact that services such as these will have on the person in the home. We feel that we've been successful in these goals based on the numbers of people who've seen the demonstration, the additional numbers of people who've come to see the demonstration to see what it's all about. I should point out that MITRE is a firm that does not engage in the manufacture or sale of such equipment. We were primarily interested in demonstrating feasibility, and as a result, we picked up equipment that was available off the shelf. In our informal survey in Reston, when we asked people what they would be willing to pay for services such as these, and we're well aware that these are a biased lot of people because these are the people who come out to see technology such as this, and they're the types who think it's neat, and they're the types who are going to pay for this. This informal survey has shown that people were willing to pay, two-thirds of the people surveyed were willing to pay on the order of about $3 a month, in addition to a typical CATV service cost of about $6 a month for a home calculator service. About 50% of the people thought they could part with 50 cents a month for additional library services, such as the ones that you're seeing here. To do this in a more scientific fashion, we've proposed, and the National Science Foundation has accepted, we're entering a phase one, which is a 9-month study of the impact of interactive television, not just the ticket-like services which I've shown here, but all the interactive services that can be made available through cable television. With respect to the future, in terms of the problems that we see, we foresee problems, obviously, in privacy. Right at this moment, Mr. Schlafly of the Teleprompter Corporation, in a session called What's Happening in CATV, since he's, I think, also the fourth to talk, is probably talking about the same question, the problem of privacy. It's a very important question that all of us have to be concerned with if you make information such as the type you've seen too readily available. It's a problem that we hope our 9-month demonstration testing through this NSF grant that I just described helps shed some light on. It's also a good problem for the lawyers. It's not really a problem that the engineers can do much with. Another major problem is the uncertainty in the marketplace. We've demonstrated a number of services on the TV screen. There are many more that you haven't seen. I'm sure there are many more services that you could each dream up yourself. The question is, to the CATV operator, the question is, what combinations of services aggregated together will provide him with an economically viable package? This uncertainty, since the man has to put his money down, has made it very difficult for these particular services to come on. It's hoped that through demonstrations such as those being proposed in the federal government will clarify this. And finally, a question that always comes up in cable television is the question of, when you talk about more than 12 channels, who's going to pay for all these programming costs? What sort of programming will be made available? Perhaps in the next 10 years, these problems will be solved. And then, through the use of computers and the home TV set, many of us will be utilizing services such as these. Thank you.
We have time for one question. We're going to have one more short paper, and then we'll have a panel where you can ask all the questions you want. Anybody have a question they'd like to ask right this minute? Okay.
Thank you.
Want this back? How do I get this off?
Mr. Richard Harkness of Boeing is going to speak to us for 5 to 10 minutes. As an extra feature here. He's going to talk to us on telecommunications, urban form, and travel demand. Mr. Harkness received his BS from Duke University, his master's in urban transportation planning from the University of Washington, and presently he's working on a PhD program in urban systems planning at the University of Washington, and he's also employed by Boeing Aerospace Group.
Thank you, Mr. Gaffney. I'll try to keep it very brief. This afternoon, I would like to talk about one limited but important aspect of the communications revolution, namely the impact that telecommunications advances could have on urban development patterns and on urban travel demands. However, I don't think this qualifies as one of our advances in telecommunications. Looks like we're moving backwards rather than forwards on this little device. However, suppose that telecommunications advances such as high-fidelity audio, picture phone, and facsimile are found to be effective and desirable substitutes for face-to-face contacts. If so, they might substitute for the short business trips made between downtown offices. For example, a businessman wishing to contact his lawyer may find it faster and more convenient to hold a teleconference than to travel across town. If teleconferencing does become widespread, then offices would no longer need to congregate in the Central Business District, or CBD, in order to communicate effectively. Other locational determinants, such as the desire to shorten work trips or to locate closer to the skilled labor market, may dominate and lead to a more dispersed pattern of office employment in the urban area. The trend toward dense, high-rise central business districts may lose momentum, and CBD employment may remain near present levels rather than following the extensive growth curves that many cities expect. If CBD employment does not grow as expected, then some very ambitious transportation plans, particularly those calling for radially oriented rapid rail transit, will become obsolete. Finally, I will suggest that telecommunications could become a positive tool for shaping urban development into patterns that will minimize the need for additional transportation facilities. Let me illustrate these statements using a series of slides which are arranged in the following sequence. First, there are several slides of telecommunications hardware, some of which we've seen before. Then come four slides illustrating the relation between CBD work travel and the need for rapid transit. These are followed by three slides depicting an employment forecast for Seattle and the rapid transit system that was proposed to serve this growth. The final three slides illustrate one type of employment decentralization that might occur and its effect on work trips. You may notice that the following material has been taken from various transportation planning documents. It deals with different cities and in many cases is not as current as would be desirable. Unfortunately, we have very little good information about the types and locations of employment in U.S. cities. But this should change when the special tabulations from the 1970 census are released later this year. Meanwhile, fragmented data must be used. Let us take a look now at some of the more innovative telecommunications hardware, which might evolve into an effective substitute for face-to-face contacts. First slide, please. This is the Bell Telephone picture phone, which is now being placed in revenue operation in downtown Chicago. Next, we have the RCA video voice system, which freezes TV images in a storage tube, then scans them at a slow rate for transmission over ordinary telephone circuits. This system is capable of sending one low-resolution image every 30 seconds. Actual teleconferencing is not completely untried. Boeing used a rather elaborate system in support of the Apollo TIE program. Alex Reed has just described a number of laboratory field experiments presently underway, and Bell Telephone has been using a teleconferencing link, as we have just had described previously. Perhaps the first teleconferencing system open for public use is the British ConferVision, which utilizes closed-circuit TV studios in five cities. I had the pleasure to observe Alex make a presentation over the system, and I felt it was quite effective. Finally, right here in New York, the Metropolitan Regional Council is planning a closed-circuit TV network to link various governmental agencies. One of their stated objectives is to eliminate cross-town travel, which I understand can be quite difficult in this area. In my own research, I've tried to identify how telecommunications could alter urban travel demands and the viability of different transport systems. My hypothesis at this time is that telecommunications might have its most dramatic effect upon commuter transit systems designed to serve central business district office employment. The rationale is as follows. The highest travel demands occur during the peak hours, and the majority of peak hour travel, as you can see by the blue, is composed of work trips. Since transport facilities must be designed to handle peak hour loads, it becomes evident that the volume of work travel is the key determinant in sizing urban freeways and transit systems. Shopping, social, and recreational travel does not contribute significantly to peak hour demand. Therefore, the substitution of telecommunications for these trips would not significantly reduce the need for new transport facilities. In addition to the concentration of work trips in time, they are also concentrated in space. The next slide shows the location of work trip destinations, or jobs, in the Chicago area. Notice the large number of trips that end in the Chicago Loop. This large volume of trips, funneled into a very small area, places considerable stress on the transportation system. Often freeways are not able to meet this demand in an acceptable fashion, and special purpose rapid rail transit systems have been the classic answer. This slide shows the destinations of trips using rapid transit. Notice that this system is used almost exclusively for CBD travel and has practically no use for trips ending elsewhere. The next slide underlines the dependence of rail systems on the central area. The left bar shows that 53% of all subway and elevated riders on the Chicago system were bound to the CBD, and fully 80% were bound to the central area. It is evident that radial rapid transit is a very special purpose system, which is only needed for and justified by dense concentrations of central area employment. This is fine for Chicago. With its historical patterns of concentrated employment, radially oriented rapid rail has been necessary and appropriate. But what about future patterns of urban growth? Will they reinforce old centralized patterns or create a new dispersed pattern? What is the nature of CBD employment? Is it growing or is it declining? Unfortunately, good data on CBD employment trends is virtually non-existent. What I will do is quote from Meyer, Kane, and Wool. While the statistical information available on CBD population or employment is admittedly unsystematic and fragmentary, in no instance is there any evidence of sharp increases in CBD employment. It is even doubtful that central office employment has been growing in CBDs, and nearly everyone interested in these problems agrees that the future of downtown areas depend heavily on central office employment. Unquote. In spite of such evidence, there are a number of cities which are planning transport facilities on the basis of questionable forecasts calling for large increases in CBD employment. Seattle provides an example, even though their system has been twice defeated at the polls. This figure shows several forecasts of employment in the Seattle Central Business District. The one used by Metro estimated a growth of 173% between 1961 and 1990. From the indicators in the upper left of this slide, it is evident that services or office employment was expected to account for most, if not all, of this growth, since manufacturing, wholesaling, and retailing had all been declining in cities of similar size. In any case, a 46-mile rapid rail system costing $1.3 billion was proposed. This system was focused on the Central Business District and was forecast to derive over 50% of its patronage from CBD travelers. There are two critical questions. First, given recent trends in office decentralization, and given advances in telecommunications, which should make decentralization more attractive, will this employment growth forecast for the CBD actually occur? If not, the rail rapid transit system is probably not needed. Conversely, if it were built, it may become an underutilized economic white elephant. Two, would it be better to encourage a decentralized city supported by telecommunications, or a concentrated one requiring high-capacity mass rapid transit? With a number of cities such as Washington, Baltimore, Los Angeles, and Atlanta now planning rapid rail systems, I believe a substantial effort is needed to answer these questions. In conclusion, let me simply indicate one possibility for office decentralization and give one of its implications for travel. This slide shows the present pattern of CBD work trips, which converge to a central office. The next slide illustrates what might happen if that office moved to a suburban location and used telecommunications to maintain its contact with other firms still in the Central Business District. Studies of this situation in England and in the United States show that some workers would resign rather than move or endure the lengthened commute. Others would relocate, as shown by the dotted lines, and would enjoy significantly shorter work trips. A few would tolerate longer trips rather than move. Finally, those fortunate ones living near the new office would benefit most of all. The net result would probably be a significant reduction in the average trip length. Data from Philadelphia substantiates this conclusion. The blue bar on the left shows the travel time for persons living in the suburbs and working in downtown Philadelphia. The blue bar to the right applies to persons living and working in the suburbs. If this relation were to hold in the future, job decentralization could greatly reduce the time spent in commuting and the need for new transport facilities. The objective of this brief presentation has not been to comment on the overall social desirability of decentralizing expected CBD growth, but rather to suggest a possible impact of the communication revolution on the need for rapid transit to the center city. Thank you.
Now we're going to have an opportunity to ask the various panelists questions, and they're going to have the opportunity to ask each other questions. Would the speakers please come up and take a seat at the table? Now, who from the audience has a question? Sir.
I have a question regarding rapid communications.
By the way, would you please address it to a particular individual?
Yes, I'd like to address this to Mr. Reed. I wonder if you could elaborate on the role of rapid communications in terms of conservation and also in terms of this 16T system, particularly to differentiate between hard copy graphics and soft copy. And would a solid copy graphics system employed in the ContraVision or 16T system answer the need for
I think I ought to explain that in our laboratory work, we're studying entirely the question of the face-to-face communication. We don't give these people any kind of graphics capability in the laboratory. And so we don't have any information from that source on that question. As far as the survey work is concerned, as you say, we've indicated a need for it. But in our own field trials of either the audio or video conference system, we are not providing graphics at this time. Therefore, anything I can say is really just based on general impression rather than on any experimental results. On your point about ContraVision, as in the original Bell system, the plan there is simply to provide an ordinary television picture, 5 megahertz television picture of the document. And it's my own opinion that this is only marginally adequate. And I think that what we've got to look for is systems of higher definition and higher resolution than that. I think that the question of what bandwidth you'd require to achieve an acceptable transmission time is a very open one. I believe there is some work being done on this at Bell Labs at the moment. But certainly we have no information at this time as to whether, for example, 5 seconds would be acceptable or whether you could go to 15 or whether you would have to go down to less than 5 seconds. But I think there's an urgent need for work in this area. The only thing I would say is I think that soft copy display is likely to be a display, an ephemeral display on a tube as an adjunct to video conferencing is likely to be the most useful thing. Although I've no doubt there'll be a place for hard copy in general business use. But I think what we need to do is to look at how we can get, with these presently available storage techniques, how we can get a decent resolution out of narrow band channels.
Another question? This gentleman's next.
Pope.
Please speak loudly up if you can.
Pope, do you expect any service in resting in the near future while polling? If so, how is that institutionalized within the political life of resting?
Well, MITRE is a separate corporation from the Reston Transmission Company. Reston Transmission Company is owned by one of the multiple system operators. The question of whether or not they're going to go to some sort of polling-like scheme, I certainly can't speak for them. I would imagine in a couple of years that they'll be headed towards that. I don't think Reston is going to be a place that the system operator that owns Reston would want to demonstrate the polling capability. Now, relative to our National Science Foundation grant, where we're going to be studying things of this nature, again, I can't be sure that within the 9-month period when we're going to be working with Reston that it's going to be there. I could answer your question in the general context of what about polling. Right now, today, in Los Angeles, they're either in the process or within a couple of weeks will be actually testing out polling systems for cable television. It's Thetacom, yes.
Is there a charge to the person doing the polling?
Well, I hate to. I really can't be sure. In terms of how it's going to operate, I think the best way to say it is right now it's very much experimental.
Gentleman up in the front here.
Yeah, this is Alex. This system is probably going to be quick, but it seems to lead to more radical social changes.
Can you please speak up?
Yeah,
it's being recorded.
It seems to lead to more radical social changes. Three, I kind of go along with one, but very realistically. One is that to develop your teleoperators to the point where they can actually work and do many of the jobs, they'd actually be able to, most probably be actually machine control totally, in which case you would actually tend to go out and do work. Now, my following that up to tend to be some sort of a system where some kind of economic support system, which you can't do But now, the way you set up your remote stations, you're not working on them. But for those who would be, you also tend to lean towards the need better than housing. And if you're going to have it in terms of what enabled remote stations, you want to lead to housing problems. You mentioned people could change jobs and stay in the same place. That also leads to the other thing, is they could stay in the same, or they could change places and stay with the same job. So not only people might stay in one place more often, they might rather move more often if you have to move to the same job. Now the other thing that we need to understand, and I don't particularly like this, this is far-fetched, maybe it's your full-scale system. But if you tend to have a lot of people going into remote stations, there are also other jobs that can only be done in terms of fixing equipment and some of the basic operations can only be done at the industrial locations. And that might be taken to an extent developing the UPS system of society. That's as far as
well, as as far as the problem of computer control, that the teleoperators would be advanced enough to be completely computer controlled, it's probably true that, the trend is in that direction. However, I'm fairly familiar with the developments in artificial intelligence and pattern recognition, and it's going to be a long time before computers are able to do the type of visual pattern recognition that people can. And so I tried to mention the fact that it seems to me that you want the computers to control these devices in order to upgrade the productivity, which of course increases the wealth of the society in general and the particular worker who's getting the salary in particular. I think it's going to be a long time before you can put people out of work in many of the areas where people are just required in order to do the pattern recognition and the goal planning. I agree that probably in the future some serious changes in the economic system and the distribution of wealth are going to be necessary when we do get robots that can do essentially everything that a human can do. I don't really understand your question about the housing problem. Well, the housing problem, it seems to me, comes back to the fact whether the people have good incomes or not. If you have good incomes, you have good housing. If you have poor incomes, you don't have good housing. I think the problem of moving more often is increasing the freedom of the individual, which I don't think anybody would particularly disagree with. And the question about the two-caste system, I really don't know what to say. That's too speculative.
Sir? Well, I really don't think so. I think it would increase your freedom of choice to live in communities which had distinctive cultural features, as opposed to every community in the whole United States being homogeneous in the sense that if you move from one suburban community to another, you really can't hardly tell the difference.
Well, I'm referring primarily to the immediate neighborhoods in 3 or 4 block areas.
Well, I don't think it's necessary that a remote station service a homogeneous type of worker. The type of communication facilities required, it seems to me, are very general in nature and could probably serve a very heterogeneous group of services. And particularly within a remote station itself, some of the workstations may be somewhat specialized, but I would think that in a workstation that would service, say, 50 workers, you could have practically any mix of employments that you would care to think about.
I think this gentleman here is next.
Originally, the automatic trees were powered by water wheels, and the work locations had to be within the range of a shaft and a belt. Today, the transmission line is no longer so, and I wonder why you can see the need for having the manufacturing operations in place where they have to be conducted by a tunnel operator, when it would be possible to have light machine work done in the worker's home and merely send the hamper or container around to pick up the finished product. The service is facsimile drawings and so forth. And the worker only process paper can be serviced by facsimile in both directions. And you thought about this kind of thing.
Well, I think that's certainly true, but on the other hand, I don't think anyone's ever going to put an oil refinery, for example, in their own home. And that's a serious problem. For example, in the state of Maine, it's a big question whether they're going to bring oil refineries into the coasts of Maine with all the pollution problems. It's a real question. Do you want the pollution or do you want the income? And the people are really torn betwixt and between because the small communities in Maine are not economically viable. People can't keep their children at home because there's no jobs there. But on the other hand, if you bring an oil refinery in to a wooded, peaceful community, obviously you've got all sorts of smoke and smells and oil spills. So as far as I can see, the advantage would be that you could put the remote stations in the village in Maine, and you could keep the oil refineries down here in New Jersey where everything's already smelly anyway.
Wait.
Ways of discriminating against foreigners, which have, which we've employed for many years. You can always put a tax on the overseas communication channel. That's purely a political problem, and it's been dealt with for a number of years. So I see that neither as an argument in favor nor against. You can use the same political means with this system as you can with any other.
Again, we have not done anything that I would call scientific in terms of getting reactions. The responses have generally been, hey, that sounds like a good idea. In other words, they've almost always been favorable. There's one particular person in the MITRE management up near the very top that for some reason is very much annoyed by the one-second updates. It bothers his eyes. That's the only negative response I've ever heard. Unfortunately, it's an important negative response. No, I'm not. Well, again, this is only one. This is the only person we've ever heard, but he has a lot of clout in terms of making his voice known.
I'm wondering if the slower refresh rate would diminish the information transfer only slightly, but use the annoyance factor.
Well, we do plan to study this further, and we have the capability on. Again, this is really something that fell out of the system we have. It was really never the intent to do this, and they have varied it up to television rates. Up to updates as slow as 1 every 10 seconds. I really have no hard data that I can give you.
Sir?
Mr. Albus, your discussion of the scheme seems to simplify in some respects. You talk about increasing productivity, which in many ways can reduce the net aggregate employment. At the same time, you're talking about increasing the opportunities for ghetto dwellers or rural dwellers. If you're talking about lower overall employment demand. How are you going to increase the employment for these people without decreasing it somewhere else? And then in terms, just what you will have done is you will change the right or the option of access to employment, which you won't have done anything but even out where it will for you.
Well, there's always historically been questions as to whether increased productivity is good or bad. In point of fact, real wages always follow productivity. If your productivity does not go up, real wages of the total society cannot go up. The standard of living of the society is totally dependent on the productivity. So increasing productivity merely means you're increasing the wealth of the society. Now, how you distribute the wealth of the society is a different question. But there's no law of conservation of wealth. In order to make one segment of the society richer does not necessarily mean you have to make another segment poorer. You can make the entire society richer by increasing productivity. And that's the only way, in fact, these are economic matters which economists have studied for years, but it's fairly elementary that the standard of living of the society is isomorphic with the productivity of the industries.
Sir?
I would like to ask Mr. Cook, if the cable layout for a two-way system would not be quite different from the cable layout for a one-way system, and whether he thinks that in the future there will be digital communications instead of FDM systems.
Was the question, would the layout for two-way cable systems be quite different from one-way? Yes, for a number of technical reasons, the cable system layout for two-way would have to be different than one-way. In fact, there's a very recent article in the IEEE group on broadcasting, an article by Andy Barnhart of the Gerald Corporation that gives a number of, lists it out very carefully, pointing out that there are problems with respect to noise pickup in the return direction. Because of the diplexer filter breaking up the two directions of transmission, there are delay distortion problems. With respect to whether or not it's going to be digital in the future, that's really my own speculation. I suspect there is. My background at Bell Labs was always in the digital area primarily, and I somehow suspect that particular technology is certainly going to catch up in a large measure in the cable area. Again, that's strictly my own view.
I wonder if you have given any thought, and I'm sure you have, but you share with us your thoughts about carrying the picture phone conference scheme all the way saving the people, the 12 people, and go to that one room, and while they're going to that room, why not have just a picture phone conference bridge?
Yes, okay. There is that kind of capability planned within the picture phone system itself, and it's got a name, they call it something called VOVCOS, Voice Operated Video Conference System. And it's the kind of system where a number, 6, 10 people, could crawl a bridge, and you'd have the same kind of voice switching. In other words, when a party was talking, he'd be seen by all the others, and he would be seen himself. And that's been, the concept has been explored and is planned for sometime in the future.
I'd like to pursue that question a little further. If you look at the big ESDJ issue, entirely devoted to picture phone. You get the impression that such capability is fully in hand and just around the corner. I'm rather amazed to find out where primitive state of research is.
I don't know if you asked a question or not. Did you ask a question?
Well, I guess so.
What was the question?
Are you telling us that it is, in fact, a long way before such a locker room?
No. I was specifically referring to the conference kind of bridge that he talked about. Everything that you, at least most of the things which were labeled as here and now in the BSTJ are in fact here and now. That particular service feature is not here right now.
The problem is people don't have picture phone sets. When people, you want to talk, you have picture phone sets, you'll be able to talk in the conference mode.
Yeah, but the implication in that journal was that was exactly the case, and there was no problem with still exploring the human factors angle.
I don't know if there's a little misunderstanding here that I could clear up. As I understand it, the group video conference system that we were shown pictures of is at a comparatively early stage of development, and there are still a number of human factors problems to be solved. But the multi-point conference bridge arrangement with automatic voice switching between separated locations is, as I understand it, fully worked out and fully engineered and simply waiting to be offered when there's a need for it. Or is that over-exaggerated?
That is an over-exaggeration. The concept has been tried, and when the time is appropriate, we'll do it. But the picture phone system is in service. It is commercially available.
This video conferencing service, though, what happens if two people speak at the same time?
Same thing that happens if two people speak in the same room. It gets a little confusing. It locks up on probably the loudest talker. We have polite people in the
Mr. Rampus, in the switched model of teleoperators that you showed, have you considered how to handle the supervision problem, which normally in industry is handled by small group social interactions in the supervisory workers? Here you're showing, or some of the graphs you showed, workers scattered around more or less at random, at least geographically, far apart, who presumably could be organized in some
Well, of course, that's a very serious problem and would require a great deal of systems analysis when you actually got the systems and you set up a production line to produce a particular item. I think there would be no general solution to that. That each particular manufacturing process would probably have its own solution. One thing which I alluded to would be is the sense of presence. The person, when he steps into the control booth, should have the feeling that he is in the work area, just as in these link trainers. A pilot is put into the link trainer and he feels that he's in the cockpit of a 707 or whatever it is. So that the workers would have the sensation that they were at the plant working with the various machines and other teleoperators which were there. So they would cooperate with other teleoperators the same as if they were there in person. I don't know whether that really addresses your problem or not.
The only point I was trying to make was that in many studies in industrial psychology, they determined that the attitude of workers towards the other workers, towards the supervisors, and so on, has quite a lot to do with the actual productivity that's realized out of the physical plant. And that is a matter of, you might say, worker morale and so on. They have problems in the coal mining and so on. There are small groups of things that workers working in isolation at the same time don't do as well. And I was just wondering how the switching that you're talking about, in the sense could be that you're doing each day or you get this cooperation, you get the job that you accept the most monotonous or super.
Well, I think there would have to be a lot of human factor studies that went into these psychological problems. I don't think anything that you can answer in just a speculative sense.
Mr.
But I think an important thing is the computer assists so that the operator is not terribly fatigued and his work level, the interesting parts of his job are really raised in that he is supervising now a complex piece of machinery as opposed to putting in nuts and bolts and that type of thing.
Thank you.
I wonder if I could just respond to one or two of the points Mr. Alvis has made. And I hope the note I strike won't seem too dissident. I'd like to make voice a specific worry, which is I think that your remark about the need to feel a presence and the remark about the link trainer demonstrates to me an extremely dangerous possibility here, which is that one simply goes in to try and imitate what would happen prior to the technology. I don't think there's any evidence that it would be necessary or indeed desirable that he have a sense of presence there. And I think in a wider sense that to imagine that we will move from factories peopled by human beings running around into a factory kind of peopled by metal human beings running around seems to me to be quite wrong. I mean, I would have thought that, you know, if you looked at the thing ab initio, you would, a remotely controlled factory would be quite a different kind of thing from what we now think of as a factory. And I mean, I'd suggest, in fact, that the way this separation from the place of work will occur is much more through what we already see occurring, namely a rapid shift from the manufacturing sector to the service sector. That's to say, all the people who work in, many of them who work in New York City are, to my mind, in a sense, teleoperating the various plants and warehouses and so on that their organizations have. They're not remotely controlling little robots doing the jobs which were done 10 years ago. They're working through management control systems and computer systems and all the rest of it. And I mean, my belief is that we'll see a structural change in how factories are run and how businesses are organized, not simply a replacement of a human being by a robot. I'm sorry if I expressed that rather strongly, but...
Yeah. Well, I agree with you. My graphics, I think, were more to illustrate a point than to necessarily propose a specific system. However, I think there is a major difference between the... what we classically know today as automation, that is the massive assembly line in which you have a continuous process, and the automation of the future where you have individually controlled devices which can be easily reprogrammed to do short-run jobs and special-purpose things, and it can also perform a lot of services. So, In a sense, I agree with you. I think the whole industrial process would probably take on a completely different complexion, and it's dangerous to assume that we need to make anthropomorphic robots. So I'll leave it at that.
Would somebody else in the panel like to say something or address another member? Sir?
I'd like to ask Mr. Reed a question. The position on the unity committee seems to me that it's discussing the organization more about the retail business and civil service in the UK. I'm wondering if you'd gone down into a different level of study and say how an office operates in itself and how this is going to change over the next few years. You mentioned documents, access to documents. Now, I go into my office to look at two sets of documents. The darn things are the inverse. Ones in my file, which are necessary to work. Otherwise, I'd work for communications, possibly I'll do that as well, as I suppose I should. But I was wondering if by analyzing the modalities within an office, I'll get an insight on where one might change things in the future, whether you've done any work on this, whether you have any thoughts.
We've not done any work on it because the work we've done has been concerned specifically with external communication between organizational units and also has been directed very much at face-to-face contact. If I could just toss out a personal belief here, which follows on to the earlier question put to me about documents and facsimile and so on, it's my own belief that within comparatively few years that most large organizations will have all their information stored and carried around in some kind of electronic digital form. And in fact, I go beyond that and suggest it's just a personal belief that within 5 or 10 years, everybody who works with their mind is going to have to learn to work with a keyboard so that the information, whether it's a memo or a letter or a paper or whatever, is immediately entered from the human into efficiently machine-readable and transmittable and processable form. So I know this may seem far out, but I mean, I think the way things will move myself is towards a situation in which anybody who works with their mind works at a simple terminal consisting of a keyboard and a visual display, and that he can in that means access remotely or immediately whatever business information or general information he requires. And I mean, I don't think it requires myself a very detailed study of offices to show the benefits of that kind of thing, although obviously in terms of specific implementation and system parameters, one would need to do that.
I would like to make the point that there's a great deal of research right now going into voice recognition so that all of the interaction between the man and the computer will not be necessarily by a keyboard, and much of the input to the computer will be a direct voice.
Well, I'd accept that in the long run, but I believe it is a long run. I'm sure you'd know much more about this than I do, but the impression I have is that voice recognition is rather like teaching an elephant to waltz or something. You know, it's not something that computers are by nature well adapted to cope with. And on the other hand, it seems to me information inputted through a keyboard is something that they're very well adapted to cope with. So I would suggest as an interim stage, we're going to go through the keyboard.
But it depends how fast
people like you succeed in what you're doing.
I would say within the decade.
Well, the same pattern recognition thing that you say a man is good for and the computer is poor for, well, this is the same pattern recognition that you're saying now the computer is good for. And, you're sort of tossing both sides against the middle of this. You're saying, we're going to make the computer voice recognized, but we won't make him pattern recognize which side of the gear to clamp into the lane.
No, I'm saying that that voice recognition will come along, but I agree that it probably won't be here for 10 years. The capacity to do very complex visual recognitions, I'm not confident that that'll happen this century.
Way back there.
My question is for Mr. Reed. In your surveys, has there been any consideration of how to measure the difference of the results achieved by a meeting which is held by telecommunications as opposed to one which is held by travel, things like fatigue and travelers and other differences like this? Can they, or do you propose to extend to measure the difference of the results?
Well, I think there are two aspects of that. There's the difference in what you might call the costs of the exercise, which I would take to include the time and fatigue in travel. But there's also the difference in the effectiveness of the exercise, and this is the, although I'm afraid I skated over them very lightly, this is the precise purpose of our laboratory experiments, is to devise measurable tasks which have statistically comparable output so that we can have people carry these tasks out via one medium, via another, and actually measure in terms of statistical significance, what difference there is in their performance by one channel or another. And I think the only point I'd like to make on that one is that in general, I think we're very surprised in these experiments at how very effective this simple voice channel is by comparison with, say, face-to-face contact. And I believe myself there's a great deal of unjustified mythology about face-to-face contact. I think a lot of people have rushed into the provision or planning the provision of video systems without any sort of basic experimentation of to show what you get out of providing that visual channel. But it would be premature for me to come to any judgment on that because we're just in the middle of a 3-year program of experiments. But we're certainly aiming to do, I think, what you described there.
Getting back to this conference bridge type of video conference versus two conferences tied together with a video link. Why bother with the two conferences linked together? You've said that you've got the capability of putting everybody in their own office behind their own video phone and running around with that conference.
Yeah.
Why bother with the other?
Well, because right now, most people in most businesses do have a telephone. I think it will be a long time before they all have a visual service. So particularly in the beginning days of video service, I think it makes sense to think in terms of, now for instance, with our conference system, any of the 5,000 employees at the location can use the one room. So there's a sharing of that facility that you don't have when you try and put 5,000 sets on everybody's desk.
Yeah, but what I picture, quite possible, is stepping back a little bit from this, is sort of scattered throughout a facility, a half a dozen or a dozen video foam, similar to timeshare computer terminals now, where you go in and you get into the terminal, but you get into the video foam booth. And I wonder why the extra expense to go to this rather elaborate conference room.
I don't really know how to answer you. Once you say that you're going to have to go to a booth, it seems to me you might as well go to the room. I would agree with you. Once you have the things widely disseminated, you don't need the room. But until that time, I think the room makes sense.
Well, I get the impression from watching your thing that this is quite a bit more of an expense to build up this room with all the TV cameras and stuff, as opposed to the sort of mass-produced video foam that...
Well, you notice the final slide was one using three video phones, okay? So, that can handle up, six, eight people. I really think until the time you get them all around, that your other idea of the room is not much different. It's not that elaborate. I think it's just a matter of time.
Anybody else have a question?
We've heard today that Mr. Dallas, I believe, mentioned a direct fan in one location to operate a web box in another location. Heard that, and then we heard the concept of one man operating the total system. Which way do the panel members generally agree that we'll be going, one man on one robot or one man on many robots?
I'm sorry, I think that you somewhat misunderstood what I was trying to say there. I wasn't intending to suggest that we would have one man controlling many robots. If by way of analogy I could perhaps make it a little clearer, I think that the moonshot represents a good example of a remotely controlled operation. I think what you have there is a small number of people actually on the spot exercising these pattern recognition functions and so on. And I think you then have a large number of people, including most of the employees of NASA, some of whom are directly involved in this, in the Houston Control Center or whatever it is. They are not each controlling a remote robot. They are each performing a careful mix of specialized functions. Somebody might be monitoring a certain biological function. Somebody else might be planning what to do in an emergency. Somebody else might be wondering how much it all costs or something. I wasn't intending to suggest one man controlling many robots. I was saying that when you introduce the concept of remote control, you completely alter the system that you're dealing with, and you need to think of it from scratch. By analogy, again, on the moonshot, that if you wanted a remote control liner, I don't think you would have it, and I'm sure this isn't what Mr. Albers suggests, but I don't think you would have it manned by a whole lot of metal sailors, so to speak. You would go back to the drawing board and think, how do we design a remotely controlled fleet of cargo ships? And I think they might look very different to what we now see. So, I wasn't meaning to suggest one-to-many versus one-to-one.
Do you have anything to say on that, Jim?
Well, I might say that you might have one or two metal sailors to do things for the larger automatic systems which break down. That's one of the beauties of the idea of the robot as opposed to a mass production line. That is, the robot is very flexible and can move around from one place to another. But I think it is very important that you don't just take one man out and put one robot in. You redesign the whole system from the bottom up, and you come up with the optimum, most economical way of doing it.
I think we neglected Mr. Harkin's theory that I'd like to ask him a question. Would you care to speculate on the effect this communication revolution might have on the
That's really been the essence of what I was talking about. I don't know how viable that's going to be. I assume, if it's like a lot of the other systems, that it is dependent on a high increment of growth in the central area for its ridership. And what I'm saying is that if this growth does not occur, and there seems to be indications in a number of cities, that it's not going to occur. In particular, office firms are tending to functionally decentralize some of their more routine aspects like bookkeeping, this type of thing. It's the problem of the center city, crime, congestion, and particularly, I understand, the problem of skilled labor, which is causing the firms to want to leave, want to decentralize. And I'm suggesting then that telecommunications could be the mechanism, the tool that makes this possible, presuming they already want to. So yes, I think it could definitely have an effect on the long-term viability of BART.
Are you thinking in terms of shortening the useful life of the ART by 10 or 20 or 30 years, or what? Is this way, way off yonder?
Well, I don't know exactly how to answer that. I would expect that the trend in office decentralization might be such that the downtown areas, we don't really know what they're doing, believe it or not, but they seem to be more or less maintaining a steady level of employment. They're not radically growing in spite of the high rises, but they're not radically declining. So what might happen is that if the planners' hopes and desires come true, there will be some growth. I would suggest it won't be as much as they suspect, and as I say, they won't get the ridership they suspect. Maybe this trend will phase in about 10, 15 years. I don't know for sure.
I think we're going to have to call the meeting adjourned, and maybe some of the speakers will be here for a moment. You might, if you have any more questions. Otherwise, thank you very much for coming.